The second floor served as a salon to entertain guests, but it also housed the bedrooms of the Washington family. Toward the front of the house, a large room called the Yellow Drawing Room became Martha Washington's social domain. The long yellow drapes and furniture brightened the room, where she served afternoon tea to her friends and acquaintances. Once a week, the space was filled with several dozen guests who came to socialize during the Friday evening drawing rooms. Adjacent to Martha Washington's social room was the State Drawing Room, a larger space in which the family hosted social receptions for dignitaries and friends from across the country and the Atlantic. The president knew that space was at a premium, but he made certain that he would have his own small private office. Washington had the original bathtub removed and created a private study for himself on the second floor. A separate servant quarters for the lodging of laundresses and kitchen maids also claimed space toward the rear of the second floor. Off the hallway were two smaller rooms that had been customized for the grandchildren. Each had his or her own room. However, each child slept with one of the slaves. Ona Judge and Moll were assigned to sleep with the Washington grandchildren, and while Moll was specifically responsible for the care and well-being of the children, it would have been next to impossible for Judge to escape this responsibility as well. One of the grandchildren's bedrooms shared a door to the President and Mrs. Washington's bedroom, most likely the room in which Judge slept. She would be available to soothe the Washingtons' grandchildren when they were sick and when they had nightmares, but would be unavailable for any child of her own. Moreover, she would be on call to tend to the grandchildren at night, but also expected to respond to the needs of her mistress both night and day. Her service was endless. Most bondwomen dreaded the sleeping accommodations for house slaves, as living in the same quarters as their owners put them at risk for sexual attack. They preferred the slave cabins offered to field slaves on larger plantations. While the dirt-floored slave cabins were rough, with very little to no insulation during the cold Virginia winters or the terribly hot summers, they provided what house slaves longed for: privacy. Slaves who lived in cabins with friends and family slept in a place of refuge from the constant demands of white owners. Enslaved men and women could talk, laugh, and pray together in the crude wooden structures that served as their homes. But for house slaves like Judge, there was no refuge. The executive mansion on 190 High Street was teeming with secretaries, servants, and slaves, most of whom were male. Ona had to be vigilant. How would Judge avoid the advances of male staff, servants, or slaves who might try to force themselves upon her? She was in constant jeopardy of rape, and very little could prevent a knife-wielding assailant from forcing himself upon her. Many slave women feared their male owners and their owners' sons more than any other man, and a room adjacent to an owner could mean many sleepless nights for the female slave. Judge never accused Washington of such licentious behavior, although whispers about an encounter between the president and his brother's slave named Venus lived on at Mount Vernon. For now, as long as Washy, with whom she probably shared a room, was a small boy, Judge didn't have to worry about attack. The third floor, similar to the second, contained more spaces for living and for presidential business. Tobias Lear and his wife Mary claimed a sleeping compartment that they shared with young Benjamin, and the two other bedrooms were shared by Washington's secretaries, Major William Jackson, Howell Lewis, Bartholomew Dandridge, and eventually Robert Lewis. All but William Jackson were the nephews of George and Martha Washington. The secretaries' living spaces on the third floor were conveniently located near the president's business office, where Washington and all who arrived on official business conducted meetings. The third floor was also home to the summer room, a spacious addition that provided the necessary living quarters for family and friends to visit with the Washingtons. In the garret or the attic, rooms were cordoned off for the remaining slaves and servants who needed a place to rest their head. Next to the kitchen, The attic was the warmest place in the house, and almost unbearable during the summer months. Hercules, Richmond, and Christopher most likely slept there with Paris and Giles, sleeping in either the stables or the smokehouse. So men and women, free and enslaved, lived in very close proximity to one another at 190 High Street. The president failed to realize how such tight quarters would jeopardize his fortune. The Washington slaves in Philadelphia would learn a great deal from the free white servants who toiled alongside them. They watched their comrades receive pay for their labor, move about the city with relative ease, and make decisions about their lives, including even the right to leave their employer. These were important lessons for all the slaves who lived on High Street, lessons that Ona Judge would study and commit to memory. 5. The Blacks in the Family. With the family settled in Philadelphia, Washington began a grueling southern tour, a tiresome 3-month trip that took him from Maryland down to Savannah, Georgia. Whenever possible, the president would return to Mount Vernon, checking in on his estate, which stubbornly avoided financial success. He also used his home visits as moments to rest and re-energize from the constant and almost maddening pace of presidential business. Mount Vernon was Washington's safe harbor, but the tranquility he so desperately needed was shaken when the president read through his mail. A troubling letter, written by Tobias Lear on April 5, 1791, aroused deep concerns for the president. His finances were once again in jeopardy, not because of a poor tobacco harvest, but because of his investment in human bondage. Attorney General Edmund Randolph appeared at the executive mansion, wanting to speak with the president regarding a pressing concern. The former governor of Virginia would have preferred talking to the president about such delicate matters, but Washington was in Virginia, and just as she had done so many times in the past, Martha Washington stood in as her husband's social substitute. Perhaps the two sat in the yellow drawing room, exchanging brief pleasantries while they waited for the Washington slaves to serve tea or lemonade. She would quickly discern that her visitor was upset, and that Randolph's visit would require delicacy. Mrs. Washington typically had Ona Judge by her side, but she would have dismissed her slave before such a sensitive conversation took place. Angry and frustrated, the Attorney General confided in the First Lady, telling her about a problem that plagued slaveholders who resided in Philadelphia. Three of his slaves had run off, and the Attorney General knew that he would not be able to get them back. As a top-ranking lawyer in the nation, Randolph never believed that his slaves would quote the law of Pennsylvania back to him. But they did just that. And to make matters worse, they were correct. Randolph told the First Lady that his slaves had boldly given him notice that they should tomorrow take advantage of a law of this state and claim their freedom. Pennsylvania was a place, he warned, where visiting slaveholders like the Washingtons could lose their property, thereby suffering great financial loss. Slaveholders in Philadelphia were vulnerable. Randolph reminded the First Lady that Pennsylvania law required the emancipation of all adult slaves who were brought into the Commonwealth for more than a period of 6 months. The Attorney General either took for granted that his slaves would never learn of the law, or believed that they were unfathomably faithful and would decide to remain enslaved to their master even when the law did not require it. Randolph offered his own experience as a cautionary tale, suggesting that the president's family be careful about their own slaves, fearing that those who are of age in this family might follow the example after a residence of 6 months should put it in their power. This warning gave Martha Washington reason to pause. The First Lady understood the seriousness of the house call, as well as the need for discreet and swift action. She listened to Randolph intently, thanked him for his visit, and quickly began discussions with Lear about the best plan of action. Her husband had to be notified immediately, and the slaves who lived on High Street needed to be kept from such inflammatory news. But the president's house was not spacious, and voices carried through the hallways. Very little remained private in a space that was typically filled by 20 or more people. Just as Randolph's slaves came to understand and utilize the gradual abolition law, so too might the Washington slaves. It would be painfully embarrassing and financially damaging if the president's own slaves turned the laws of the state against him. Tobias Lear knew that the Washingtons were sitting on a powder keg, and it was his responsibility to make certain that it didn't blow. As the sixth-month mark since the first family had taken residence in Philadelphia was fast approaching, Lear's letter to the president asked for advice and guidance, and for Washington to give directions in the matter respecting the blacks in this family. The president was aware that Philadelphia's popular sentiment surrounding the issue of slavery was unlike what he had encountered in New York. There was little public chatter about the Washingtons and their caravan of enslaved Africans arriving in New York in the spring of 1789, but things were different in Pennsylvania. While he was familiar with the gradual abolition law, the president was caught off guard about the precarious status of his own slaves, and within a week's time, Washington responded to Tobias Lear's request for advice. The president had given the issue quite a bit of thought, rationalizing his circumstances as different from those of the Attorney General. Writing from Richmond, Virginia, Washington told his trusted secretary that Randolph was in some ways responsible for his own misfortune. So that he could practice law in the Commonwealth, the Attorney General made the decision to become a citizen of Pennsylvania. Randolph chose to take the oaths of citizenship, therefore agreeing to observe all the laws of the state, one of which was to emancipate his slaves within 6 months of his arrival. Washington rationalized his situation was different. He lived in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania as a necessity of his employment, stating that, "My residence is incidental as an officer of government." But even with a justification in place, the president was cautious. Washington wrote to his secretary that there were some citizens, abolitionists, who were in the practice of enticing slaves, even when there is no color of law for it. The president worried that his own slaves were in danger of exposure to the epidemic of black freedom, and although Washington believed that his slaves were better served and cared for in his possession, he understood the power and the allure of freedom. Washington wrote, "For although I do not think they would be benefited by the change, yet the idea of freedom might be too great a temptation for them to resist." He asked Lear to continue with an investigation of the laws of Pennsylvania, and in the meantime, the president, Mrs. Washington, and Lear crafted a plan of circumvention. The Washingtons would not break the law. They would simply work around it. Ona Judge learned quickly that life in Philadelphia was quite different from what she had come to know in New York. Her slave status was somewhat of a rarity in her new city, and unlike New York, there was a much more strident abolition movement. In terms of thinking and legislating freedom for all people, Pennsylvania was advanced compared to New York or New Jersey, becoming the first state to gradually dismantle slavery. Philadelphia took the lead in the state's movement to unhinge lifelong bondage, and by the time Ona Judge moved to High Street, slavery was on its deathbed. Pennsylvanians wrestled with the moral dilemma of African slavery as early as the 17th century. The colony was only 7 years old when the first group of Quakers began to question human bondage. Founded by William Penn in 1681, Pennsylvania became a colony known for its significant number of Quakers who did indeed own slaves. Many Quaker slaveholders agreed with founder George Fox, who advocated for the humane treatment of those held in bondage. Good treatment was relative, and compared to the life-shortening tobacco farms in Virginia or the rice plantations in the Carolinas, Pennsylvania slavery did enjoy a kinder reputation than did its southern neighbors. Nonetheless, slavery continued, and within the Society of Friends, a great debate over human bondage brewed for nearly a century. Beginning in 1688, a number of Germantown Quakers declared slavery oppositional to their religious beliefs. But their cries fell upon deaf ears as Friends began to shun their own members, labeling them troublemakers, going as far as to cause financial calamity to the small business owners who dared to question the morality of slavery. Although they were a consensus-driven religious organization that believed in equality and the light of God within all men, the financial gains connected to slavery and the racial stereotypes that bred fear of a free black community halted a meaningful 17th-century abolitionist movement. It was the Quakers living outside the city who took the first bold move to push the Society of Friends to ban African slavery. In 1711, Friends from Chester County asked the yearly meeting to prohibit Quakers from purchasing new slaves. While no formal mandate was issued, it was recommended that Friends withdraw themselves from the slave trade. What the Quakers began on the outskirts of Philadelphia would culminate in the first anti-slavery law in the new nation. This monumental piece of legislation, passed March 1, 1780, tackled the explosive issue of slavery and set the standard for gradual emancipation in the North. It still allowed white owners to squeeze every bit of uncompensated labor out of enslaved black bodies until they were 28 years old, middle-aged for the 18th century, leaving broken bodies and weary souls to find new ways for living after emancipation. The process was slow, but Judge found herself living in a city that promised to end slavery and was in the midst of doing so. Surrounded by anti-slavery sentiment and laws that undermined their financial investments, the Washingtons knew they had to work quickly and quietly if they were to protect their wealth and their reputation. The president needed a solution to the problem of slaveholding in Philadelphia, one that would work for many years. So the Washingtons devised a plan. The couple would shuffle their slaves to and from Mount Vernon every 6 months, avoiding the stopwatch of Pennsylvania black freedom. If an excursion to Virginia proved a hardship for the family, a quick trip to a neighboring state such as New Jersey would serve the same purpose. The hourglass of slavery would be turned over every 6 months, and the president knew there was no time to waste. Still in Virginia, the president sent clear and direct orders back to Philadelphia. The slaves at the executive mansion needed to leave the state, and soon. Washington decided that his wife should plan an expedited trip home to Virginia, bringing all of their slaves back to the safety of southern laws. The president was primarily concerned with his adult slaves, whom he, erroneously as it turned out, believed were the only ones capable of freeing themselves under Pennsylvania law. But while the president was adamant about protecting his human property, he was only 2 years into his first term, and in no hurry to agitate the powerful anti-slavery forces in Philadelphia. Washington preferred to handle his private affairs with discretion and to deceive the public if necessary. The president directed his secretary to reveal his intentions to no one except his wife, stating, "I request that these sentiments and this advice may be known to none but yourself and Mrs. Washington." Just as she had prepared for the move to New York, Martha Washington executed important plans in the absence of her husband. But this time, it had to be done in secrecy. Although they faced significant time constraints, the president wanted his wife to quickly gather up their human property without setting off any alarms. The slaves had to be kept in the dark, for if they knew why they were to accompany Mrs. Washington on her trip to Virginia, they might run off, just like Randolph's slaves. As directed, Martha Washington began to think strategically about a trip back to Virginia. She always looked forward to her Mount Vernon visits, but now her trips would not only be for rest and relaxation. The First Lady was tasked with protecting an investment in human property, property that would eventually be passed down to her heirs. On April 19th, just 7 days after the president corresponded with Tobias Lear, Mrs. Washington wrote to her niece Frances, Fanny Bassett Washington, who was back home at Mount Vernon. She inquired about family and friends and prodded for news, hoping that she would hear word about an impending pregnancy. But most importantly, embedded in the First Lady's letter was an excuse for why Ona Judge's brother Austin would be returning to Mount Vernon ahead of the others on such short notice. Mrs. Washington explained to her niece that while she was really in no position to spare Austin's services in Philadelphia, she needed to fulfill my promises to his wife and to allow Austin to reunite with his family. Austin's stay in Virginia would be short, a gift from a benevolent slave owner, or so it would seem. The First Lady never let on to her niece the real reason for sending her slave back to Mount Vernon. Austin's 6-month residency limit was about to expire, and Mrs. Washington needed an excuse to shuffle him out of state. The Washingtons must have trusted Austin, for not only did they allow him to travel back to Mount Vernon alone, but they gave him resources with which to do it. Austin was given a total of $11.66 for the trip, an amount that would take care of the cost of his stage to Baltimore, transportation from Baltimore to Alexandria, and food and lodging throughout his journey. The Washingtons began to breathe a little easier, knowing that the plan to move Austin out of Philadelphia was securely underway. Martha Washington could now focus on preparing for the family's trip back to Mount Vernon, an excursion that would bring the rest of the slaves on High Street back to Virginia. But Tobias Lear interrupted the Washingtons' fleeting relief with more bad news. The first family needed to worry about the residency clock for all of their slaves, not just the adults. Washington had been confident that Christopher, Richmond, and Ona Judge were exempt from Pennsylvania's gradual abolition law because of their status as minors, but Lear reported that the president's beliefs were incorrect. After another discreet conversation with the Attorney General, Lear told the president that his 3 juvenile slaves could also claim freedom after 6 months' time. The secretary wrote to the president that those slaves who are under the age of 18 might, after a residence of 6 months, apply to the overseers of the poor, who had authority to bind them to a master until they should attain the age of 18, when they would become free. This report was a misstatement, as most black children in Philadelphia were indentured until the age of 28. But according to the law, if Christopher, Richmond, or Ona Judge stayed in Philadelphia longer than 6 months, they would have a chance at freedom. They might have to wait, but in Philadelphia, the opportunity existed. Imprudently believing that he could prevent his slaves from hearing about the laws, Washington insisted that the utmost discretion be used regarding their plan of slave rotation in and out of Philadelphia. More than a loss of labor was at stake. If Ona Judge and her enslaved companions uncovered the truth about their slave status in Philadelphia, they would possess knowledge that could set them free. Power would shift from the president to his human property, making them less likely to serve their master faithfully, and eventually they might run away. Washington wrote that if his slaves knew that they had a right to freedom, it would make them insolent in the state of slavery. Lear had less faith in the idea that the slaves would remain in the dark than Washington. There were people in Philadelphia who would help, if not encourage, Ona Judge and her enslaved companions to take their freedom. Tobias Lear noted his concern to Washington, stating, "There were not wanting persons who would not only give them the slaves' advice, but would use all means to entice them from their masters. If Washington's slaves didn't escape, they would likely be impudent and therefore worthless, ruined by Northern freedom. The loss of slaves would signal more than a loss of face. Still teetering on the brink of financial insolvency, Washington continued to live beyond his means, and losing property would only add to his financial woes. Ona Judge, Maul, Austin, Giles, Christopher Shields, and Richmond belonged to the Park Custis estate, and it was the president's responsibility to manage its human property. If anything happened to his wife's slaves, George Washington would be held responsible. In his letter to Tobias Lear, the president wrote, "It behooves me to prevent the emancipation of them, otherwise I shall not only loose the use of them, but may have them to pay for." It was clear. All the president's slaves would need to be carefully monitored. By April 24th, Austin was back at Mount Vernon, and Richmond was scheduled to sail to Alexandria on the following day. Mrs. Washington took no chances and quickly organized a trip to Trenton, New Jersey, taking both Ona Judge and Christopher with her, restarting their 6-month residency clock. With Giles and Paris accompanying the president in Virginia, Maul and Hercules were the only slaves left on High Street who needed rotating. Maul would not immediately travel back to Mount Vernon, a suggestion that the president and Mrs. Washington must have trusted her not to attempt escape. But the Washingtons had deep concerns about the remaining enslaved member of the household. Hercules, the cook, would need close watching, for many reasons. As the president's famed chef, Hercules cultivated a relationship with the Washingtons that earned him an elevated status and a modicum of respect. Viewed as a crucial member of the staff on High Street, he prepared the president's breakfast hoe cakes, white corn mush patties, and Saturday evening meals of saltfish hash. The Washingtons relied upon Hercules and allowed him the opportunity to make an income by selling unwanted kitchen slops. Used tea leaves, animal skins, and leftover stock could fetch a decent price at market, permitting the enslaved chef to earn between $1 and $200 a year. With his personal income, Hercules purchased fine clothing that he displayed on his evening walks. Dressed in a velvet-collared coat with bright metal buttons, shiny shoes, and a pocket watch, Hercules left his master's house to socialize with his new Philadelphia friends. His gold-headed cane and cocked hat reminded everyone of his elevated financial status, even though he was a slave. The Washingtons were quick to believe that if any of their slaves would use the law to find freedom, it would be Hercules. After all, he had the financial resources to support himself. They would not risk it. They decided to send Hercules to Mount Vernon ahead of the family's annual summer travel to Virginia, an odd mandate that would have raised questions given what a prominent role he played, but a move that was necessary to pause the stopwatch of freedom. Though the Washingtons got away with the subterfuge surrounding Austin's return, the lies and reasons given for Hercules's premature departure were exposed, even with heightened discretion. There was an information breach in the president's house, though the perpetrator remained unknown. Someone did indeed tell Hercules that under the laws of the state he could free himself, and that it was now obvious his owners were making excuses to send him home. He knew that the Washingtons did not trust him. Hercules had decisions to make, and he had to make them quickly. If the chef took advantage of the law, he would have to choose between his freedom and his family, a dilemma faced by every enslaved person who considered escape. His daughters Evie and Delia were motherless small children back at Mount Vernon, and his son Richmond, who was no favored possession of the president, worked at his side in Philadelphia. If Hercules refused to return to Mount Vernon, he would, in essence, walk away from his family. The reprisals that his children would surely confront drove the chef to think seriously about his options. Hercules chose his family over freedom. Perhaps it was an easy decision, or maybe he arrived at his choice after much deliberation. In any case, once his decision was made, the chef knew that he needed to prove himself trustworthy to the Washingtons. In order to remain in his position in Philadelphia, he must erase their concerns about his loyalty. Hercules needed an opportunity to make his case to the president's secretary, and he would not have to wait long. By the end of May, Lear informed Hercules that he would travel back to Virginia and watched the chef for an unusual or stubborn response. Lear wrote to the president, "If Hercules should decline the offer which will be made him of going home, it will be a pretty strong proof of his intention to take the advantage of the law at the expiration of 6 months." The secretary told Hercules that the first family was aware of the information breach, and what happened next told the Washingtons exactly what they needed to know. Hercules appeared agitated and desperate when he explained to the secretary that he had no intentions of leaving his owners and that his faithfulness had never swayed. Whatever theatrics Hercules employed were convincing, and the secretary accepted all that the enslaved chef told him. Lear wrote to the president that Hercules was mortified to the last degree to think that a suspicion could be entertained of his fidelity or attachment to you. The chef managed to convince Mrs. Washington and Tobias Lear that he could be trusted to stay with the family in Philadelphia beyond the month of May and the expiration of his six-month residency. On June 3rd, Lear purchased 2 new shirts for Hercules and gave him at least $7.20 to cover the cost of his transportation, food, and lodging for his trip back to Virginia. Lear's confidence in Hercules was stronger than ever as he wrote to the president that the enslaved chef has accordingly continued here till this time and tomorrow takes his departure for Virginia. His performance worked, and Hercules was once again in the good graces of his owners. He would have to wait another 6 years before he had the opportunity to take his freedom. On February 22nd, 1797, Hercules ran away and was never seen again. It was George Washington's birthday. The Washingtons' plan to circumvent the law was successful, and for 5 years, from 1791 to 1796, the president and Mrs. Washington carefully transported their slaves to and from Pennsylvania. Tobias Lear assisted his employers in their slave shuffle, but he also made certain to voice his opinions about human bondage to the president. "You will permit me now, sir, and I am sure you will pardon me for doing it, to declare that no consideration should induce me to take these steps to prolong the slavery of a human being, had I not the fullest confidence that they will at some future period be liberated, and the strongest conviction that their situation with you is far preferable to what they would probably obtain in a state of freedom." Both Lear and Washington held fast to paternalistic assumptions about African slavery, believing that enslaved men and women were better off with a generous owner than emancipated and living independent lives. Decades later, Southerners would justify the institution of slavery with descriptions of the supposed benefits that came with enslavement. According to many Southerners, slaves were better cared for, better fed, sheltered, and treated almost as though they were members of the family. Northern emancipation left thousands of ex-slaves without assistance, and Southerners charged that free blacks were living and dying in the cold alleyways of the urban North. Many believed Northern freedom to be a far less humane existence, one that left black men and women to die in the streets from exposure and starvation. But Washington must have suggested to Lear in earlier conversations that he would eventually release his slaves from bondage, prompting Lear to continue assisting the president. He would safeguard the Washington secrets and continue shuffling Ona Judge and the other slaves at the executive mansion from the north to the south every 6 months at least. On each lengthy trip back to Virginia, Ona Judge would have thought about what she lost and gained by going home, understanding the growing divide between the orbits of the slaveholding South and the fragile freedom of the North. 6. Life in Philadelphia. On a Tuesday evening in early June, Philadelphia's Southwark Theater prepared to welcome the president and his family for a production of The Beau Stratagem, a comedy written by George Farquhar. The Washingtons arrived at the theater and were promptly taken to the east stage box, from which hung the United States coat of arms. The box was decorated with red drapery and cushioned seats, and soldiers secured the entrances at each stage door. Filled with racy scenes and irreverent innuendo, the production thoroughly entertained the Washingtons, and they left the theater wanting to share their experience with friends and family, even with their slaves. The following day, Ona Judge was given permission to attend the same theater with her brother Austin and the always well-dressed Hercules. An 18th-century stage performance was typically a 4 or 5 hour affair that included music and dance performances. Judge took her seat, perhaps in the pit or in the rear of the balcony, and watched a story unfold about two young men who had lost their fortunes and were determined to find wealthy wives. The lead characters are confronted with many obstacles on their quest to find fortune, but in the end meet with love and wealth. While the performance entertained theatergoers, it would have reminded Judge about her station in life. She was gifted a ticket to the play, but she would never be able to look for love and fortune, not while she remained a slave. The slaves at the president's house enjoyed the cosmopolitan pleasures of their new city. In addition to the theater, Judge attended the circus and went to see the tumblers perform whenever her owners would allow it. Sometimes the president or Mrs. Washington would give small financial gifts to their slaves and allow them to shop. On February 22, 1791, the president's birthday, Judge, Austin, Hercules, and Moll received $1 from the Washingtons with a suggestion that they purchase gifts for their family members and send them home to Mount Vernon. Christopher only received 50 cents, an implication that his owners were less than pleased with his service. Christopher had big shoes to fill, since the disabled William Lee had returned to Mount Vernon. Washington had a notable bond with the longtime service of Lee, and it's likely that no one else could build such a relationship with the president. Judge experienced life as an urban slave, growing familiar with Philadelphia, its cultural venues, and the social elite. Accompanying Mrs. Washington on her social calls, the slave girl matured into a young bondwoman who met many of the city's leaders and influencers. Although she was not an invited guest, her presence among the wives of policymakers, bankers, and politicians exposed her to extremely sophisticated people. Judge would never have socialized with Mrs. Washington's friends, but she certainly became familiar with the slaves and servants of the nation's top movers and shakers. She became a recognizable face among both white and black Philadelphians. But there were places and venues that Judge would not have visited. The watchful eyes of her masters were omnipresent, and the Washingtons would never allow their slaves to interact closely with the free blacks of Philadelphia. 3 years before Judge's arrival, a group of free blacks, including Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, came together to form the Free African Society. It was the first black mutual aid society in Philadelphia, and its goals were to help widows, the poor, and fugitive slaves who were unable to provide for themselves. Donations of firewood, clothing, and food were offered to black Philadelphians who found themselves mired in paralyzing poverty, and financial contributions were distributed for decent burials. The Washingtons would have stopped at nothing to keep their slaves away from the city's black leaders and trailblazers. But this was an almost impossible mission. Inevitably, Ona Judge became acquainted with free black Philadelphians, some of whom, when she made the decision to flee, would become the most supportive friends imaginable. Judge spent the next 5.5 years, albeit rotating every 6 months back to Mount Vernon or out of state, in Philadelphia, serving her masters while she watched the rest of Philadelphia's enslaved population break free from the bonds of slavery. Her interactions with paid servants, contracted hired help, and with her own enslaved housemates informed her thoughts about her life and the possibilities of freedom. After the information breach regarding the Washington slave rotation, it would have been virtually impossible to keep Judge in the dark about the laws of the state. If Hercules knew the law and the Washington's intentions, then Judge most certainly did too. Judge may have believed that as a minor, she could not claim freedom as easily as Hercules or one of the other adult slaves who lived in the president's house. If she escaped her masters before their calculated trips out of state and hid among the free blacks of Philadelphia, she could contest her slave status, but the risk was high. Because Judge was under the age of 18 years old, her enslavement would convert to a contract of servitude, one that could place her fate into the hands of an unknown person until she reached the age of 28. She could be hired out to serve a particularly cruel employer, someone who might demand a more physically taxing or dangerous type of labor. Worse yet, her new owner could exploit her sexually, a fear that every female slave and servant harbored when presented with new labor assignments. While Judge may have preferred freedom, she must have felt relatively safe in the president's house and made the decision to stay put for the time being. Ona Judge was not the only person in Philadelphia who wondered about the future. While emancipation touched the lives of many black men and women who lived in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, it was a process that was slow and cumbersome. Pennsylvania may have been revolutionary in its move to gradually end African slavery, but for black Philadelphians, especially those who were enslaved, change didn't come fast enough. Some refused to wait for freedom, choosing to live the vulnerable life of a fugitive. During the 1780s, more than 160 slaves took their chances and headed north from the city, looking for freedom and anonymity. Most runaways were young black men, but the few women who attempted escape in Philadelphia often did so to join free husbands scattered about New England, often with their children in tow. Although the number of free people continued to grow, black men and women always remained in the minority in Philadelphia. It must have been strange to live in a land that was predominantly white. Aside from living on a plantation that counted more than 200 enslaved people, Fairfax County, Virginia, where she had spent the majority of her life, was home to a large proportion of black residents. There were close to 4,500 blacks living around Mount Vernon, though only 135 of them were free. Judge was accustomed to living around enslaved black people, and Philadelphia was, in reality, a white city. In 1790, the first federal census takers counted more than 44,000 residents who made their home in Philadelphia and its surrounding counties. Black men and women comprised only 5% of the city's population. Judge watched as slave owners emancipated their male slaves at a much faster rate than their women, creating a larger pool of female slaves who would spend much more time in bondage. As domestic help was a necessity and a labor shortage evaporated the pool of good servants, artisans and merchants held tight to their female slaves. Judge must have known some of the enslaved women living in Philadelphia, a reminder that she was not alone. But she would have also calculated that her peers would eventually find freedom through the laws of the state, and that this was not a possibility for her. Most of the black women who lived in Philadelphia labored long hours as domestics. Employment opportunities outside of cleaning homes and washing clothes were nearly impossible for women of any race, but especially for women of African descent. Free black women took in laundry, sold pepper pot soup and fruits and vegetables on the streets, or took to rag picking, the latter only by those who were destitute. Searching through trash heaps, they gathered discarded clothing or bits of cloth and cleaned them for resale. It was dirty work and offered the smallest of financial rewards, but it was work, and it often allowed black women and their children to evade hunger and malnutrition. Judge witnessed black poverty and understood that freedom was by no means an easy endeavor. Judge also watched black men and women make their way out of slavery through indentured servitude. Just like George Washington, many slave owners who moved to Pennsylvania, and there was a flood of them, as a result of the revolt during the 1790s in Saint-Domingue, which would become Haiti, looked for ways around the law that stripped them of their human property after 6 months. Many whites in Pennsylvania acknowledged that abolition was a fait accompli, so to slow it down, slave owners emancipated their slaves and indentured them for lengthy periods of time. But there were amazing things about the city that Judge would have to witness from afar. Free black communities were organizing, creating churches, schools, and social societies, all within a stone's throw of Judge's residence. While Judge probably rode or walked by the buildings owned by free blacks, she would not have stopped to interact with its members. If Judge were caught speaking to or socializing with free blacks, she would put her presence on High Street in jeopardy. She had seen how the Washingtons handled the transgressions of her enslaved housemates. The Washingtons would simply not tolerate the contagion of freedom seeping into the lives of their slaves. If there was the slightest suspicion of fraternizing with free blacks, Judge's life could be turned upside down. Judge knew that no one's place, including her own, was secure on High Street. The spring of 1791 brought the first round of change at the president's house, beginning with the enslaved postillion Giles. While on a southern tour with the president, Giles was severely injured, perhaps thrown from a horse, a common and life-altering accident. His injuries were so grave that Washington had no choice but to remove Giles from service and to leave him behind in Virginia, never to return to Philadelphia. This must have been devastating to Giles for several reasons. Aside from being forced to return to Virginia for good, he would no longer serve the Washingtons in a position of distinction. Giles was to be trained in some other form of service, but this would most likely be something such as broom making or clay digging, jobs that were the least desirable for slaves at Mount Vernon. Like Giles, the young slave Paris would also not return from Mount Vernon to work in the president's house in Philadelphia, but for very different reasons. Paris also accompanied the president on his tour of the southern states, but his service was unacceptable to Washington. The president wrote to his secretary, "Paris has become so lazy, self-willed, and impudent that John, the coachman, had no sort of government of him. On the contrary, John says it was a maxim with Paris to do nothing he was ordered and everything he was forbid. This conduct, added to the incapacity of Giles for a postillion, who I believe will never be able to mount a horse again for that purpose, has induced me to find Paris some other employment than in the stable. Of course, I shall leave him at home." Perhaps Paris had been contaminated by the contagion of freedom in Philadelphia. Or maybe a difficult southern trip brought out the impudence in the young slave. Whatever the reason, Paris remained at Mount Vernon for the next 2 years before illness claimed his life. The removal of Paris was still fresh in the minds of the slaves at the president's mansion when Christopher Shields, the only literate slave on High Street, was sent back to Virginia. It is possible that his literacy left the first family uneasy, deciding that his residency in Philadelphia was too great a risk. Having lived with Shields for 2 years, Judge would have likely been saddened by his departure. The transition at the executive mansion was no excuse for Judge to slow down or to reflect about loss. In fact, it required all the slaves on High Street to work faster, complete extra work assignments, and to simply carry on. Judge understood that as a slave, most of what happened in her life was beyond her control. But she would not stand alone in her vulnerability. All the residents of Philadelphia, including the Washingtons, would soon confront the fragility and unpredictability of life's circumstances. During the late summer of 1793, one of the worst public health crises hit the nation's capital with unabated destruction. Men and women suffered from headaches, chills, sharp pains, stomach upset, and jaundice, followed by the spewing of black vomit and internal bleeding. Yellow fever sickened and killed many, and thousands of citizens fled from the city, including George and Martha Washington, who, along with Judge, retreated to Mount Vernon to escape the death and devastation connected to the dreadful outbreak. 18th century medicine was still far from a stable science, and few understood the actual cause or transmission of the disease. Although yellow fever is acquired via the bite of a mosquito, many believed the illness was associated with foul air, throwing physicians far off the track of preventive care or a possible cure. The yellow fever outbreak did not dissipate until the first frost in November, and the death toll was staggering. Between 4,000 and 5,000 Philadelphians perished, including the wife of Washington Secretary Tobias Lear. One of the first victims of the dreaded fever, Polly Lear died on July 28th at the age of 23. Yet out of what could only be considered a grim situation, black community leaders Richard Allen and Absalom Jones saw the opportunity for black residents to gain footing in the struggle for black rights in Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, their hopes were based upon the faulty beliefs of the well-known physician Benjamin Rush. As one of the top doctors in Philadelphia, many turned to him for guidance during the outbreak. Rush believed incorrectly that people of African descent were immune to the disease, proclaiming that no black men or women had come down with the fever by September. He reached out to the famed black leaders of Philadelphia, asking for their help in recruiting black men and women to lend a hand as nurses and grave diggers. Allen and Jones saw this request as an opportunity to uplift the profile of blacks in the city. As emancipation moved forward, the pursuit of racial equality became a priority in emerging black churches and among the growing free population. In the minds of Jones and Allen, assisting whites would prove that black men and women were capable of being good citizens and were worthy of the abolitionist assistance offered to them by leading Philadelphia Quakers. Black leaders saw this moment as an opportunity for African-American residents to reverse the detrimental stereotypes of blacks as lazy, impudent, and unreasonable emancipated men and women. If black assistance during this horrible epidemic could help alleviate the growing racial tension in a city that fitfully accepted emancipation, then Jones and Allen were ready to recruit significant numbers of black men and women to help nurse the sick, to hold the hands of the dying, and to dig the graves of those who perished. And they did so with great optimism. The problem with their plan was that Benjamin Rush was wrong. His assumptions about black immunity to the disease were incorrect, and blacks died at the same rates as did white Philadelphians. As the city trembled under the heat of the summer, the plague not only took the lives of white Philadelphians, but it also struck the city's black population. Indeed, African Americans represented 10% of all deaths related to the fever. Yet insult was added to injury when whites began to hurl accusations of black impropriety during the outbreak of fever. Blacks were accused of exploiting white vulnerability by robbing dying men and women and by ransacking abandoned homes. An opportunity to ease racial animosity between white and black Philadelphians was lost, reminding free blacks, servants, and the enslaved that gradual emancipation would not end centuries of racial violence, stereotypes, or tension overnight. The epidemic did do something positive for Judge, however. Fear of contagion prompted the Washington household to pack up for a visit back to Mount Vernon. Once back at her birthplace, she got to know her new niece. Betty Davis had given birth to another daughter, a baby who would share a name with her aunt. Little Oney would remind Judge of the importance of family and of the gift of motherhood, two things that she would never have while serving the Washingtons in Philadelphia. Once again, the trip back home to Mount Vernon was bittersweet. As autumn ushered in cold weather, killing disease-carrying mosquitoes in the nation's capital, the yellow fever epidemic of 1793 finally came to a close. The Washingtons and their slaves, including Judge, returned to Philadelphia in December, laying eyes upon the ravaged city. As Philadelphians mourned the loss of 5,000 residents, Judge would have noticed more than just grief in the air. The city was rife with racial tension of a sharper kind. Blacks had just buried their own family members, only to suffer accusations of hideous behavior. Judge most certainly heard the stories of black anger and resentment from those who had lost loved ones in a grand attempt to prove themselves worthy of freedom and equality. No matter the status, free or enslaved black people were still considered the inferior race. Even when people of African descent offered up their lives to help whites, they were still rejected and scorned. This was a valuable lesson for free black leaders like Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, but it was also a cautionary reminder to people like Ona Judge. Life as an enslaved person robbed her of her dignity and her personhood, but life as a free person, although preferable, would not serve as a conduit to easy living. She thought deeply about her circumstances and about her future, but her reflections came to a sudden stop when she received devastating news about her brother, Austin. Like Judge, Austin served the Washingtons in New York and Philadelphia and traveled back and forth to Mount Vernon every 6 months. Austin was scheduled to return to Virginia in December of 1794 and was eager to see his wife, Charlotte, and their five children. As one of the more trusted slaves, Austin was sent home unescorted to Mount Vernon with $20 to cover the cost of his travel and lodgings. 3 days after his departure, a letter arrived for the president from Maryland telling of a terrible accident. Austin had experienced tremendous difficulty navigating a river in Hartford near Havre de Grace, Maryland, and was, with great difficulty, dragged out of the water. He was likely to lose his life. Indeed, shortly after being dragged from the river, only in his mid-30s, Austin died, leaving behind his family at Mount Vernon and his sister in Philadelphia. The news of Austin's death no doubt shocked Judge. Austin had been her only familial link during her stay in New York and Philadelphia, and now she would be forced to endure the rest of her time in the North without any kinfolk. The news was too much for Austin's mother to bear. An elderly Betty, now in her late 50s, was sickly and worn thin from a life of enslavement. To make matters worse, winter, always a difficult time for the aged, especially those who suffered from chronic illness, and for the enslaved who lived in uninsulated cabins, was just around the corner. She did indeed grow ill, and in January of 1795, George Washington was notified about her death. The president saw her death as merciful, relieving the slave from her debilitating illness. He wrote, "It is happy for old Betty and her children and friends that she is taken off the stage. Her life must have been miserable to herself and troublesome to all those around her." As a slave owner, Washington thought not only about the misery that Betty endured, but he thought practically about her required care. Elderly or sickly slaves were considered a nuisance and a financial drain, as the cost of feeding and clothing them was never recouped. For Washington, Betty's death was a financial relief, but to Betty's family, it was an insurmountable blow. In 1795, the only four of the original slaves to arrive on High Street, Moll, Hercules, Richmond, and Ona Judge, welcomed a new slave by the name of Joe to the Washington household. There were psychological changes afoot as